Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Pork production reduced about 90 million pounds this month, and that mainly just truing up to recent data, so third quarter slaughter data, lower and lower weights combining there as well. No change in 2025.
World Ag Outlook Board Chair, Dr. Mark Jackanowski.
We raised our hog price forecast by 25 cents per hundredweight, so it's now at $59.38 per hundredweight for 2024. But we're expecting to see some weakness going into 2025. We reduced our forecast by a dollar per hundredweight for the new calendar year, and so it's now at $57.75 per hundredweight, and that would be down $1.63 year over year. And that just reflects a little bit, relatively speaking, weaker demand for pork that we've been observing lately.
This is Agriculture Today.
This is really one of the fun things that you get to do as governor is bring Nebraskans together that love this place, care about this place, and we talk about getting things done.
Nebraska Governor Jim Pillen on a recent Ag and Economic Summit in Kearney.
This is a very pragmatic, straightforward conference, and we're talking about competing, and we're talking about action plans so that we can grow Nebraska. And the goal is to make sure that we appreciate how extraordinary the people in Nebraska are. What's the greatest thing about Nebraska? It's the people. And then we have this extraordinary pot of gold, the Ogallala Aquifer. It's really important that all Nebraskans start thinking about our aquifer from seven generations perspective, because we have to become, we've done great the last 60 years, but we have to be proactive, not reactive, for the future, because there's going to be extraordinary opportunities that could put unwarranted demands on. So I think it's just really, really important that we bring people together. And then, you know, we talked about threats. It's really important that we start getting ourselves educated a little bit more. We quite honestly live in a little bit in a bubble in Nebraska. We just can't comprehend some people's egregious thoughts about what we do and how we feed the world and save the planet, and they try to paint a story that's 180 degrees opposite. So it's important that we're all aware of all that.
And while what happens at a summit is important, he actually says what happens after is more important.
What's really important that we do is we go home and then we're inspired to take action. Example, housing. Gigantic, right? Housing, childcare, critical in every community across the state. Well, what's important is that community leaders go home and come up with plans that doesn't rely on government. We, the state of Nebraska, can provide some seed money, but we have to invest. And as I have said, let's start thinking about investing in workforce housing. It's kind of like when you bought your first farm. Whenever you buy a farm, it never makes economic sense. That's how we have to look at workforce housing, where we come together as community members, put money in a fund, develop and build workforce housing, and recognize we're not going to get a return for 15 years. The communities that do that, they're going to thrive, they're going to explode, they're going to continue to grow and have incredible quality of life, because there's incredible careers for everybody across state. So we have to get housing. There's water. We got to talk about how we can become proactive with water and start measuring what we do with water, because the more we measure it, the less we use and the less expense we have. And then, of course, we have the aquifer for seven generations. Talking about our people, our greatest resource, stop the brain drain and make sure that we are recruiting folks to come to Nebraska, because what do we have? We're the safest place in the world to live, for crying out loud. Let's not take that for granted. Last year I was at Burwell for a ribbon cutting, and I said, you know, we're the safest place. I don't ever lock my pickup. And the mayor of Burwell says, of course we don't, because somebody might need it. That's what we got to be talking about, because our young people want to live here and they know it's the safest, and we got to make sure they can know what extraordinary careers that they have.
We hear a lot of talk about a bioeconomy, but he says it offers benefits.
We have extraordinary opportunities because of the new bioeconomy. And what's really important to set us apart is, you know, we have to have plenty of power and electricity. So making sure that we can take and using animal waste and do anaerobic digestion and capture the methane and make clean natural gas, an example. Making more energy across the spectrum. So if we don't get energy, if we don't get more electricity, it's going to be really difficult to grow our economy. It's essential that we make that happen, and this will help.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
It's important for us to get the science right. It's important for us to have measurable results and tying those results to specific actions on the farm.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack on the Climate Smart Commodities effort.
Now that sounds like a relatively simple process, but everybody in this building knows depends on where you farm, depends on what you farm, depends on what your land is like from acre to acre. So it's not easy to get that data and the quantification to a measurable and verifiable point that somebody can trust it. So that's why your RCPP program and your expansion of it and the number of producers that may be involved in it and the number of states and the number of different localities and different circumstances within those 167 counties are really important. It's why the work we're doing with the Climate Smart Agriculture Commodity Initiative in all 50 states involving over 100 commodities, 198 practices, doing the same thing of incenting behavior, measuring and monitoring that behavior, and then verifying the results from it, and then connecting it to, if you do this, it gives you this result. So once you've got that, then the next question is, will it be recognized, and under what framework or structure do you have to create so that it will be recognized, and who's going to be doing the recognition? So that's why we've taken $300 million from the Inflation Reduction Act, and we've set it aside, and we are essentially investing it in an effort to create protocols and standards for these ecosystem service markets to essentially utilize in judging the value of particular practices that farmers will present for credit. So we're going to try to create the protocols and standards by which this verified information can flow into and be trusted and be sort of farmer friendly and to recognize the difference between agriculture and some other industries. Okay? And then we're also going to take time and resources to determine who out there is really in the business and can be trusted to do a good job of verification so that farmers will know here are a list of entities, organizations, companies, businesses, whatever, that you can go to and have them validate or verify what you're doing on the farm, and their validation, their verification will be recognized by the entities that will be investing in the results. So that's basically what we're doing. But it obviously depends on the continuation of the IRA, right? It's choice to pass it, choice to fund it, choice how you use the funds, and a choice to keep it. Some people want to do away with it. Some people want to change the direction of it. So it's, I think, important for people to understand these choices, right? That's the system, and I think over the course of the next months, year or two, we're going to see a maturing of that system. And as we learn, as we get information from all these projects that are working, we verify that information, we create protocols, we create verifiers, we will create that system that ultimately will create that additional revenue stream, which I think is critically important to maintaining the small and mid-sized farming operations in this country, which I believe are critically important to rebuilding and revitalizing the rural communities, which I believe is important for our national security.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
My name is Christian Good, and I'm owner-operator of Christian Good Farms in Macon, Mississippi.
Testifying earlier this year before a Senate Ag Subcommittee on supporting young farmers.
Since my childhood, I've always been involved in our family farm in Noxubee County, raising corn, soybeans, cotton, beef cattle, and catfish. After graduating high school, I went to Mississippi State University to get my Bachelor of Science in Agribusiness. Although I grew up in agriculture, I established my own operation shortly after college. In 2020, my wife and I, Laura, had the opportunity to purchase our first farmland tract of around 125 acres with financing through the Farm Credit System. We have expanded to over 300 acres of corn and soybean production through long-term land leases. Farming in today's overall economic environment poses some real challenges for both beginning and experienced farmers. My fellow Mississippi farmers are facing one of the most difficult years in quite some time. First and foremost, our operating costs are at an all-time high. Inflated costs for seed, fertilizer, fuel, technology, equipment, and parts and repair costs continue to erode the profit headwinds for producers, both young and old. Most farmers in my community made one of the best crops they've ever produced in 2023, and due to these record input costs, many still lost money. Second, the markets for the commodities that my farm produces are currently in a significant price downturn, yet are above the statutory reference prices established in the 2018 Farm Bill. In just 2 years, we have seen the market price for corn drop $2.40 a bushel, or roughly 35%. The same can be said of the soybean market that has dropped roughly 18%. The third economic challenge that all of us are facing is the rising level interest rates on our farm operating loans. Just 4 years ago, interest rates in farmland, real estate loans, and farm production loans were between 3 and 4%. Now the same interest rate stands between 8 and 9%, more than doubling the cost of borrowing for agricultural producers. The current interest rate environment is a substantial roadblock to many producers to expand their operation as needed, and is certainly a challenge to many beginning and farmers and ranchers like myself. And finally, as we kick off the 2024 crop season, the lack of meaningful safety net that our current Farm Bill provides is a real concern for farmers in my community. The farm generally participates in price loss coverage, PLC program, provided by the USDA Farm Service Agency, designed to provide a price floor that we receive. The statutory reference prices in the 2018 Farm Bill are so outdated that I can confidently say that if I were to receive those prices for corn and for soybeans, my farm and my family's farm would be out of business. I highlight these challenges to provide some context into the importance of Congress passing a strong Farm Bill in 2024 for the future of all farmers, especially those beginning young farmers. I'd like to now give you my perspective on some of the numerous challenges that young and beginning farmers face in my state with Farm Bill programs, and provide you with some recommendations to address some of these concerns. One challenge on my farm is having an adequate amount of base acres to allow for me to enroll in the FSA price loss coverage option program or other Title I risk management programs. My farm is roughly two-thirds underbased. My recommendation would be to devise some way for young producers to build base without adopting a policy for mandatory base updates. The House Agriculture Committee just recently marked up a farm bill provision that will allow producers a one-time option of building base on their current farming operation. For young farmers, this change would be monumental. Additionally, the House bill makes significant adjustments to the statutory reference prices for most commodities, bringing them more in line with today's market situation.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
You think about this, you know, last September we did a one-year extension. I thought, well, a little long, you know, not have to use that. But here we are again, coming towards September, and we still haven't passed a farm bill.
He represents the 4th District of Iowa, Randy Feenstra, a member of the House Ag Committee.
I talked to our chairman, Chairman G.T. Thompson, who's doing a great job. He's coming to our Farm Progress show next week. But we want to get it on the floor, the U.S. House floor, in September, and that's the goal. But our problem is there's still no movement in the U.S. Senate, and we're just begging Senator Stabenow from Michigan, who heads the Ag Committee in the Senate, to start moving on some policy. We know we've got some top lines, but here's the deal. We can't negotiate with ourselves. We got to have something coming out of the Senate that we can work with. And that's our concern right now.
One frustration from corn growing states has been the lack of progress on year round E15.
Yeah. You know, this is such a struggle. I live in my district. We're the largest biofuels district in the country, in Iowa, obviously. 42 ethanol plants, 11 biodiesel plants. E15 year-round is paramount. When we start talking about liquid fuels, it really, you know, we can talk about mandates and everything, but in RVOs, but really it comes down to if we can put 15% in everyone's tank, it's a difference maker. And that's what we want to try to do. And there's so much support. And it's not just Midwest. It's all southern states, from Texas to Kansas to Oklahoma, that say, you know what, this keeps liquid fuels on the map instead of going down the electric vehicle route. So we believe maybe we can get it done in lame duck, hooking on to another bill, but it's going to be one of the key initiatives come next year. I mean, this has got to get done.
Another challenge for producers, especially new farmers, crop insurance.
Yeah, you think about that next generation, and it scares me because there's so many retirements coming in from our producers and from our farmers in the next several years. And we want to make sure not only that they can buy the land, but frankly, it's the input costs that are just destructive when they go for that operational loan to that bank. So what we want to do, and this is part of the farm bill that simply says, can we give them a 15% discount for the first 2 years on that crop insurance? That's one of the most costly things that a farmer buys besides the seed, is that crop insurance. And then have a discount for 10 years for that new producer who's buying that land. So when that land goes down to that next generation, at least they can cash flow what they're doing and have that operational loan and make it work.
And then there's the topic of foreign land ownership.
Yeah, here again, we want to protect that land. We want that producer to pass it on to the next generation. You know, that American farmer belongs to that American farmland. And we get so worried about foreign investors. Obviously, we hear a lot about China, but there's other ones also. We want to make sure that we're overseeing, and CFS is looking at any purchase over $5 million. Who's purchasing it, and is this a purchase going to be approved or not? Why are they buying it? You know, obviously, we have grave concerns in North Dakota when land was bought next to a Air Force facility. You know, we have to know not only for security and safety, but also for our protection, our energy protection. Every other row goes to biofuels right now. So we have to know who's buying it, why are they buying it, and is it more important that stays with the American farmer?
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Every agency has its own portfolio. Our portfolio basically, in terms of direct support for the industry, are utilizing resources to expand access to E15. So that's why we did the infrastructure program and why we sought expansion of it in the Inflation Reduction Act and why we are continuing to make announcements to increase the number of grantees. You're going to continue to see that.
Speaking at the 2024 American Coalition for Ethanol Conference, Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
So that's a direct way of helping. The other way is to be the voice in the room. All right, so the way this works, when Treasury makes guidance, they don't just make it on their own. They actually engage in what is called an interagency effort, and they bring in all of the agencies that have a piece of the action, and they say, what should we do? How should we think about this? And everybody brings in their own sort of a focus and bias, right? Transportation has one focus. Energy has one focus. EPA has one focus. We have one focus. We're the voice of the farmer, if you will, in that room. So to the extent that we're the best informed, to the extent that we have concrete data, we have concrete examples, we have an indication of acceptance by farmers of the notion that, yes, climate smart does matter. Climate smart is going to help my soil. It's going to improve my productivity over time. And I've got data or I have experience to prove it. To the extent that I have and we have that kind of information going into that room, then we can be far more persuasive. Why? Because when we go into that room, we're the expert. All right? And they basically have to defer to us. If our science is weak, if we don't have examples, if we don't see farmers embracing this, then it's harder to make the case, right? So to the extent that as you're collecting data and information from this project, which is really important, as we're collecting data and information from the Climate Smart Commodity Initiative companion effort, collecting that data, assembling that data, and then using it to make the case. Really, really important, number one. Number two, you have relationships with land-grant universities. Land-grant universities have access to data and information. Land-grant universities are considered to be experts in this field. They need to lend their voice on behalf of the industry and on behalf of farmers. That's a voice that is a bit nonpartisan, if you will. They obviously support all the industries. So to the extent that they they are perceived to be sort of an honest broker, they can be powerful. So encouraging them to reach out, to let other agencies know about the importance of this, because they have connections with all those agencies, right? And then third, you have capacity and connections with local and state officials. And it's important for them to engage in this effort and for them to communicate to the White House, to the Treasury Department, to the Transportation Department, to whatever department they have a relationship, that they're supportive of this. And you can encourage them to do so. And if you do all of that, and you've, then it strengthens our hand, and we come out of that interagency process with a guidance that basically, in our view, the goal here is to create more flexibility, more options, more choices for farmers to participate. We've crossed the threshold. They now recognize that ag's got to be part of the equation, part of the solution. Now the question is, to what extent?
And this is Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
My name is Kevin Lusher, and I'm a third-generation dairy farmer from Hawthorne, Florida.
And he testified earlier this year before a Senate Ag subcommittee hearing on supporting young farmers.
I'm honored to be here today to share my experiences and to advocate for the programs that are vital to the survival and success of young farmers like me. I also want to make clear how imperative it is that Congress pass a bipartisan farm bill this year. Today's hearing focuses on helping the next generation of farmers. If we do not give young farmers the certainty of a five-year modernized safety net, young farmers will be less likely to go into the business of producing the food, fuel, and fiber that our country and national security depend on. When I returned home from college in 2016, I stepped in the management of our family farm. In 2017, I was able to take advantage of the Farm Service Agency Young Farmer Program and purchase 100 dairy cattle and 35 acres of cropland. With the dairy industry in the middle of its worst downturn in history, we decided we had to either grow or diversify if we were going to sustain our farm business. In 2019, we went back to the FSA and secured another loan to purchase 100 additional head of Jersey cattle and cheese-making equipment to help us begin our artisan creamery. We also utilized the value-added producer grant through USDA Rural Development to help market our cheese. We are now milking 300 head of Jersey cows. Dairy farming is not just a job for me, it's a way of life, a heritage that I'm proud to carry forward, and one that I hope to pass on to my own children one day. However, the challenges facing young farmers today are daunting, and without adequate support and creativity from producers, the future of American dairy farming and other small family farms like mine is at risk. Access to credit is one of the most critical issues young and beginning farmers face. Inflation continues to raise supply costs, and the price of agricultural land is skyrocketing. Starting and maintaining a dairy farm requires significant capital investment, from purchasing land and equipment to acquiring livestock and feed. Traditional lending institutions often view agriculture as a high-risk industry. When you combine that with the limited or zero credit history many young farmers and ranchers have, it makes it difficult for them to secure loans through private lending institutions on favorable terms. Programs like the FSA's guaranteed and direct farm ownership and operating loans have been invaluable to the success of our farm and to many other young farmers and ranchers. Increasing the lending limits for these programs to more accurately reflect the cost of production agriculture in today's world would enable more young farmers to access the credit they need to start and sustain their operations. Dairy farmers face unique challenges related to market volatility and pricing. Programs that offer price support and risk management tools, such as the Dairy Margin Coverage, or DMC program, provide a safety net that can make the difference between staying in business and shutting down. Strengthening and expanding the DMC program will help young dairy farmers like myself manage the inherent risks in agriculture and ensure a more stable, predictable income. Modifications to DMC will better allow our business to manage financial risk. Modifications the committee should consider as it works towards a farm bill include increasing the cap on Tier 1 coverage for DMC above 5 million pounds. The House Farm Bill increased it to 6 million pounds, but moving the cap closer to 10 million would allow for more producers to benefit. For example, our farm milks roughly 300 head of Jerseys, which is right near the current cap. Should we choose to grow our business by adding cows, we would exceed the 5 million pound cap, leaving part of our business with no safety net. Other positive enhancements that were included in the House bill include updating DMC production history, providing a premium discount for those producers who choose to enroll in DMC for the life of the farm bill, and restoring the higher love formula for the Class 1 mover. The market disruption seen in the last 5 years to the change in milk pricing formula have created huge losses to our dairy farmers. In fact, my family farm alone has lost more than $230,000 when you compare today's pricing formula to the higher of. We have continued to see losses in the first 4 months of 2024, and I believe this change is imperative when addressing the sustainability of the American dairy farmer.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Broilers, no change in our 2025 production forecast, but for 2024, truing up to recent production and hatchery data, suggests about 100 million pound increase in broiler production, up to about 46.9 billion pounds of broiler production.
Mark Jackanowski, chair of the World Ag Outlook Board, on this month's broiler production and price.
For 2024, really just truing price forecasts up to recent data. Broiler price forecast is raised by 1.5 cents per pound. It's now at 128.8 cents per pound. And that pulls some strength into 2025 as well. We raised our price forecast next year by 1.3 cents per pound and now at 127.3 cents per pound. Still, year over year, we'd be looking at a small decline. Broiler prices down 1.5 cents per pound.